Members present, that is a quorum. Please stand for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, we're going to try to zip through the first part of the agenda as much as possible since we have a lot of things to talk about in terms of the obesity prevention and complete streets and then the governor's budget proposal. So under the chair's report, are there any supervisor conference reports? Margaret Wood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On Friday morning, I attended the Healthiest County 2015 Health Summit at the Lundis Center. And the breakout sessions were chronic disease prevention, injury prevention, mental health, and infectious disease prevention. And what I liked especially about this is sponsored by the La Crosse Medical Health Science Consortium. We do really have a lot of partners that we are working with, the County Health Department along with many others. And we do plan to have La Crosse County be the healthiest county soon. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other reports? Mr. Bina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted you to know that I was to a RC&D, Resource Conservation Development, meeting. The funding on the federal level has been cut totally out of the budget by the Obama administration, and I doubt if it's going to be put back. We may not have the committee working, depending on what happens in the budget, but we have enough money in our account to operate for another year or two, even though we may not get any federal money. So things are going to be changing from the state and the federal level.
Thank you. Any other reports? Seeing none, let's go on to Mr. O'Malley.
Okay, I have a proclamation, March 2011, Human Services and Family Court Month, where staff who work in the Human Services Department and Family Court of the county literally touch thousands of lives every day who are in need of temporary or longer-term assistance to meet their basic needs or to adjust to transitions in their families, and whereas citizens who rely on county human services and family court programs range in age from pre-birth to over 100 years of age, and whereas county human services programs are designed to protect our most vulnerable populations, which include children, adults, and children with disabilities, the aging, and people dealing with mental illness, and whereas to serve and help individuals in need, county human services professionals routinely enter homes and travel to other locations in the community, at times facing volatile situations and safety risks, and whereas family court mediation and family court services strive to maintain the dignity, safety, and security of families going through difficult transitions, and whereas the individuals and entire community benefit from the investment in lives that human services and family court professionals make every day, now therefore be it resolved, La Crosse County Board does hereby proclaim the month of March 2011 as Human Services and Family Court Month and urges all citizens to join in recognizing the valuable contribution of human services and family court staff.
Moved by Vicki Burke, second by Margaret Wood. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried unanimously.
Mr. Chair, members of the board, we have quite an ambitious agenda of items to bring you up to date on. First, obviously, is probably the largest single grant that our county has ever received in the area of public health or anywhere, actually. Obviously, tonight is to bring you up to date on the obesity prevention program and complete streets policy. You'll end up hearing more about complete streets as we bring a resolution through your April cycle for Public Works and Infrastructure, Planning, Resource and Development, and, of course, Health and Human Services. So this will preview the whole sets of issues and dynamics for the April discussion that will happen. And, Doug, are you or Linda going to start off? Linda's going to start off. You all know Linda Lee, and her whole team of folks will get introduced as well, and we'll go from there. So, Linda.
Okay. We're going to start by viewing a very, very short video that basically gives you an idea of why obesity, what kind of sets a tone for what we're going to be talking about tonight, the whole obesity issue. So if you could play that.
I weighed 501 pounds. I couldn't walk more than about 9 or 10 feet at a time. I was miserable. Never even saw my daughter playing in the playground for the first 3.5 years of her life. because I could not fit in the car and I could not walk to the playground. Yeah, humiliated, embarrassed, but also just the misery of walking. Thanksgiving Day, actually, 2005. I woke up that morning and looked at my wife and daughter and said, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to completely revamp how I think about food, how I think about life, how I eat, and I'm going to start riding a bike. I need to have a bicycle made. I need to ride every day. I need to save my life. My wife, who is my soulmate, looked at me and didn't even flinch and said, okay, I'm in too. So we actually found a bike for me on Craigslist, and I did ride it about a full block. It flexed really bad. It scared the crap out of me. But at the same time, it felt amazing because that was faster under my own steam than I had been able to move in years. All of it was painful, but it was also glorious. So that led to this whole process of contacting custom frame builders, and they didn't take me seriously. But one guy responded, and he said, sure, I can build you this bike. You basically need a tandem built for one person. It's got to be strong. And I quickly learned things go better at night under the cover of darkness. I got hit with some bottles, everything from like, wow, that bike doesn't deserve to have all that on it. You know, you hear it, it's fine. You know, and if you've been fat most of your life, it's cool. But it's still, it bugs you. Do your thing. My last stand, like, you know, I'm going to go out trying this, but I'm going to really try this. I knew all of these things worked. Absolute crystal clear support of two amazing women. One amazing woman and one amazing little girl. I love being around my wife and daughter, and I love getting up, and I love going out riding and seeing people. My wife can hug me. She couldn't put her arms around me before. And I can hug her. And I can pick up my tongue.
So, this is why we're here today. If you could, yep. We're going to spend about 10 minutes kind of updating you on the grant itself, what we're doing, the different kinds, the different pieces that we're working on. And then Jack Zabrowski is going to be talking about complete streets and bike ped infrastructure. Spend about 20 minutes to 30 minutes talking about that. My technologically challenged, there it is. Uh-oh, can you... Back, thank you. The grant itself has basically three components to it. There's a media campaign, which many of you may have started to see out in the community. It started in February, and we'll be talking a little bit more about each of these components in a minute. There's a school component that looks at farm to school. That's the nutrition piece of it. And safe routes to school and after school activity programming is the physical activity piece of the school component. Then in the community, we have the same nutrition, physical activity balance. We're trying to expand the 500 Club so we have healthier restaurants. Footsteps to Health is a grocery store program that looks at trying to get people to purchase more fruits and vegetables. And Wellness Warriors is a healthy vending program. So that's the nutrition component for the community section of the grant. And then in terms of physical activity, trying to get more people moving, primarily adults, we're looking at trying to make sure that the bike pedestrian infrastructure in our community is improved so more people can walk and bike safely. We're interested in working with work sites to try and get more work sites to have active commuting programs so people don't have to take their cars to work. And then we also have a component called Strong Seniors. We've found that in our community, many senior citizens are not active. And so we're trying to find ways to encourage and increase physical activity among senior citizens. So I'd like to talk about each of those pieces. The social marketing campaign, as I said, started in February, and you can see the little, there's a poster kind of sitting up in the front by the screen. The tagline is Get Active, Cause Community Change. And what we're trying to do is to increase community demand for healthy lifestyles and a healthier environment. And you'll see, I think I put on each of your desks, whoops, a handout that looks like this. that talks a little bit about obesity and the problems we have in our community, and then the back of it talks a little bit about what the different components for the grant are. Harvest Moon Advertising is working with us to put the campaign together. There is TV, radio, print media, as well as a website, getactivewisconsin.org. And I encourage you all to go to it. It has some great information. The staff who is sitting over here have worked very hard to get information up onto the site and give you information about what each of these different pieces are doing. So we're trying to build excitement and build demand for a healthier community environment. I always liked, if you can read right under that community-wide social marketing campaign, there's a small quote, and it says, "People will change their behavior to reflect their environment. If you want healthier people, create healthier environments." And it's really true. If you make it hard to eat healthy or to be physically active, people aren't going to do it. And so we need restaurants that have healthier items in them. We need grocery stores that sell a wide variety of fruits and vegetables and healthier items. We need safe streets for kids and adults to bike and sidewalks for kids and adults to walk on. So we have to have an environment that makes it easy to make healthy choices. And that's what this is designed to do. The school component, the school section of our grant has two components to it. The farm to school piece of it is the nutrition piece. And what we're trying to do here is incorporate local foods into school meals. And the two staff that are working on that are Josh Miner and, you want to raise your hands, and Maggie Smith. So at the end of this, if you have questions about our farm to school project, please feel free to ask. What we're trying to do is help farmers, local farmers who grow fruits and vegetables, get their produce into local schools. And we see it as a win-win. It gets more fresh vegetables and fruits into the local school meal program, and it also provides an outlet for farmers to sell their produce. And this was September through February, I believe. We had placed about 5,500 pounds of local vegetables in four local school districts. And the actual price of that produce that was paid to local producers was about $8,500. So we see it as a great partnership with the local agricultural community. Mm-hmm.
Can I just ask a question real quickly?
Sure.
Do you have any standards or requirements as far as organic or not using pesticides or whatever when you get the produce and into mm-hmm. the schools?
I'll let Josh answer that. I mean, typically we have not said it has to be organic, but I think a good bit of it is.
That's fairly accurate, given the types of agriculture that exist in our region. A large proportion of it happens to be organic, if mm-hmm. certified or otherwise. But we didn't want to exclude any growers, so if growers are interested in participating, then we're welcome to have the produce.
He's got a thing.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
I was just saying it's a good question, but as a result of the agricultural base in our region being so closely situated to the Viroqua region, the Organic Valley family of farms, they have a big influence over the types of produce that's grown. So generally speaking, smaller scale, non-wholesale growers, the types of farmers who aren't traditionally already selling into these markets, just happen to be organic. But we try not to promote that so that we can avoid the risk of excluding any farmers who may not choose to go that route through organic certification. If that answers your question. Thank you.
Okay. We're also, as a part of this, trying to strengthen school wellness policies so that the farm to school program gets kind of incorporated into the wellness policies, and we see more fresh fruits and vegetables being local fruits and vegetables being offered in our schools. We also, as a part of the school component of the grant, have a Safe Routes to School program. Many of you may remember that in 2007 we got a small Safe Routes to School grant that allowed us to work with three schools. This has really expanded that program to 13 schools in La Crosse County. Each of them have a school liaison, and the activities are wide, but each of them must have a walking school bus. And I don't know how familiar you are with that term. It's kind of like a regular school bus in that an adult leads the bus, quote unquote, from a point several blocks or a quarter of a mile away from the school, and she walks or he walks the children into school so that the children are supervised as they walk to school. And the routes are chosen to be safe, to make sure that they have sidewalks, et cetera, to walk on. And Ginny, before this meeting, Ginny Lair and Becky Lukowski are the two Safe Routes to School coordinators. And Ginny had given me some data from the first 3 years of the Safe Routes to School program, and they worked with Franklin, Hamilton, and State Road. And what they were seeing was, she gave me the changes in the number of kids biking and walking. And I think I have some data up there, but actually she updated it for me. So Franklin realized a 4% increase in the number of kids biking and walking over that three-year period. Hamilton, it was 9%. And State Road, it was 7%. So we're really hoping that with now 13 schools involved in this effort, you're going to realize a much greater number of kids walking and biking to school. And this, we have to be realistic. It's winter in Wisconsin. Although many of the schools did continue to have their walking school buses once a week through the winter, hardy souls. So, you know, it is possible to do it. I think sometimes the schools had different activities that they had the kids do rather than do the walking school buses and walking to school. They did more at school activities. One actually did a marathon, I believe, where they had a walking route in school. And the kids walked it, and hopefully will achieve their marathon by the end of the school year. So that's Safe Routes to School. Can you go back? We also have two contracts with after-school programs in the community. The YMCA, who does most of the surround care here in the La Crosse area, and the Boys and Girls Club. And what they have done is built either 60 or 30 minutes of activity into their after-school programming to keep kids moving. Kids get some activity at school. We wanted to make sure that when they came home or came out of school, that if they were in surround care or if they were at the Boys and Girls Club, they were still continuing to get the activity that they need. So that's another piece of the puzzle. And then in the community piece of it, we're working with Gunderson Lutheran to expand the 500 Club. One of the really important pieces of this is that we have healthier restaurant items in our area. We eat out approximately four times a week. That's the average Americans eat out each week, is four times a week. And so if we're eating that many meals away from home, we have to find ways to offer healthy options. And so 500 Club, which has been around for quite a while, was the vehicle we saw as helping to do that in our community. And so in March of 2010, we started with 29 members. They had 256 different menu choices on their menus. And since we started, Quick Trip has been added. I don't know if any of you have noticed that Quick Trip now has quite a fresh case in most of their Quick Trips. They are 500 Club members. So we've increased that by 21 members just with Quick Trip alone. And then we've added Logan High School to that, so their a la carte items are there. And Wine Guys, their snacks are now 500 Club approved. So we've lost Culver's, which had two stores. But essentially, we've met our goal of getting 50% more members, and we're going to continue to work on this because it would be wonderful if every restaurant in La Crosse had 500 Club membership. It really would. And we have a Footsteps to Health program. This is the healthy, the grocery store program that encourages people to purchase fruits and vegetables. And Tiffany Adrians and Jennifer Miller are the two people who work in that program. Tiffany is also the person who works in the 500 Club program with Gunderson. And with Footsteps to Health, what we had, Jennifer had worked with the Cooley Region Childhood Obesity Coalition to implement a pilot at three festival stores several years back. And what we found after a year of doing the program at festival is that purchases for fruits and vegetables went up a little over 8%. So we thought, okay, this is a successful way to get people to put more fruits and vegetables onto their plates. So we expanded it. When we got this grant, we expanded the number of grocery stores we were working with, adding two Quillen stores and Hanson's in West Salem. Now, as you know, Quillen's is shutting. But we have been in discussions with Festival, and we're hopeful that the new stores, once they open in the village, you know, potentially will also have a Footsteps to Health kiosk in it as well. We really have found this to be a very, very successful way because you're teaching, there's a featured fruit and vegetable of the month. The person is given information about how to prepare it, how to choose it. They get to taste test different recipes using that fruit or vegetable, and it really has encouraged people to purchase more fruits and vegetables than just putting a sign up or giving out recipes. The Wellness Warriors program is also another nutrition piece in the community. This actually is a vending machine from the Health and Human Services building. Wellness Warriors is a program that started several years ago through Stansfield Vending. They had 63 machines when we started in the county, and our goal, again, was to increase it by 50%. But what we were finding was that the way the signage was, they weren't the healthier items in the machines weren't that obvious. So what Tiffany Adrians did was design a healthy zone for the machines, and you can see the little green healthy zone along the side. And what the vending machine does, or what the vending company did, was they supplemented the price of the healthier items by charging a little bit more for the price of the less healthy items. So if I was to buy peanuts, they might be 60 cents. But if I was to buy M&Ms, they might be a dollar and a quarter. And what we have found is that when you point out healthier items, it does increase sales. And if you make it quite obvious, Tiffany kept track of sales in this particular machine. And in the month that we put the new signage in, the healthy items, the sales of healthier items, now this is available to the public as well as people in the HHS building, went from 27% to 31%. So we saw a bump of 4% in the sales of healthier items. The basement one, which is only used by employees, went from 45% to 51%. So we saw a bump of 6% there. So it is going to be expanded. I think, in fact, Tiffany, aren't we putting, there's new signage going in here?
Yes, in the basement employee lounge.
In basement employee lounge. So if you want a healthy snack, feel free. And then the Strong Seniors Program, what we're trying to do here is increase the physical activity opportunities for seniors. We've been doing activity classes at three sites as part of a pilot, and one was at Becker Housing Complex, one was at the Hmong Senior Center, and then one was at the West Salem meal site, although that actually has been moved to a church in West Salem, the Presbyterian Church in West Salem, because we're having low numbers attend. And it's been actually quite successful. In the pilot sites, when we took a look at this, we saw a doubling of weekly activity with activity programs being run at some of these sites that seniors visit. So we're really hopeful that we can keep this going and maybe expand it. And Jenny Logging is the person who is running the Strong Seniors Program here for the grant. The last piece, although certainly not least, is our interest in improving bike pedestrian infrastructure. And Jack is going to be talking a little bit about this. We want to increase the number of pieces in the bike ped plan that get implemented, especially the short range projects, because our grant will cover some of the time period there. And we want to work with 15 work sites to implement active commuting programs. The last piece of this is more of a policy piece, and that's what Jack will be talking about this evening, a complete streets policy. So I'll turn it over to him.
Jeff Schrader.
Just a quick question, Linda. Did you say that this was only where there are sidewalks? The walking school bus and things like that, that's the only in areas where there are sidewalks?
Hi, I'm Ginny, and I'm one of the Safe Routes to School coordinators. Typically, the routes are where there are sidewalks, but a few schools that don't have sidewalks, for example, State Road, they do a walking school bus where there are not sidewalks and just walk on the other side of the street.
So then this really doesn't pertain to the outlying areas, to the rural areas?
We have 13 schools, 9 in La Crosse, 3 in Onalaska, and then West Salem Elementary. We invited all public schools in the county to apply, and they had to submit a one-page application. And what we looked for was that at least 50% of students lived within 2 miles of school, because typically 2 miles, outside of 2 miles, they're bused. And so if they didn't have at least 50% of students within 2 miles, we knew we wouldn't have a big reach with the program. And we also required that they had to have safe infrastructure currently, because this project didn't fund any things like sidewalks or signage. We didn't want to pick a school to encourage a walking school bus where it was not safe to be walking. And then third, they had to begin immediately last fall when we started.
My name is Jack Zabrowski. I'm the Bicycle Pedestrian Coordinator for La Crosse County. Thank you for letting me speak tonight. A little bit hoarse. So these are the things I'm going to talk about tonight about complete streets. I'm going to talk about what a complete street is and what it isn't, some of the problems it addresses, some available funding, some endorsements from national and local organizations, and take any of your questions that you might have. So this is just an example of many of the complete streets components. You can see this as sidewalks, bike lanes, disabled accessible ramps in the sidewalks, transit stops. So just a small example of what we would like to see. So loosely defined, complete streets are, they accommodate pedestrians, bicyclists, motorists, public transport users of all ages and abilities are safely able to move along and across a complete street. I'm going to borrow a safe routes to school question, but how many of you would just like to see a raise of hands? How many walked to school when they were a kid? And how many, keep your hands up, how many of your children walked to school? And how many of your grandchildren walk to school? It just demonstrates kind of what sets a context of what we're working in here. You can see this is the way things used to be. Smaller streets, lower speeds. This is West Avenue in Maine, 1970. Easy for bicycles and pedestrians to navigate through that environment. Today what we have is 5 and 6 lane roads, high speeds, and great distances for pedestrians across. Very intimidating for children and older adults to try and get across. So incomplete streets impact health. This is an example of a street that's probably too dangerous to cross on foot. I cross it, you know, many times per week, but it's sprinting across. So it's uncomfortable and unpleasant. Incomplete streets don't accommodate wheelchairs. In La Crosse, we have roughly 1,000 miles of paved roads and 12 miles of bike lanes, so that's only 1.2%. Incomplete streets create barriers to physical activity, so they kind of discourage people from being physically active. And right now, only 35% of adults get regular physical activity. 33% don't get any activity at all. If you have any questions along the way, too, just, you know, let me know. Raise your hand. Who wants complete streets? 55% of Americans surveyed would rather drive less and walk more if they had the opportunity. Nearly one-third of Americans don't drive. So these roads that we create right now, most of them, not all of them, don't serve that one-third of the population. And that includes 21% of Americans over 65 and children are 16 years of age. A recent article in the Washington Monthly stated that young professional people are looking for compact, walkable communities. That's something that they're willing to pay for. And this talks about the next real estate boom being connected to that. This is a quote from my acquaintance. He's an engineer at a consulting firm in La Crosse. He does recruiting at career fairs. And he says, this is his quote, "Your efforts to make the surrounding area more bike and ped friendly will go a long way towards helping local companies recruit and retain excellent employees." Because it's something that we have that's unique. He said, you know, we have a nightlife and we have outdoor activities to sell people that are moving to the area. So complete streets provide opportunities for more physical activity, and these are some of the components of complete streets. Now, a complete street will be different in a rural setting and it will be in an urban setting, but these are some of the things that make it more pedestrian and bike friendly, and transit, and elderly person, and disabled. Bump outs and sidewalks. Bump outs decrease the distance that pedestrians have to travel, and also make it easier for cars to move quickly through there because they don't have to wait for the pedestrians to cross through that intersection. Okay, go ahead. So usually this is kind of a bad example picture. It was nice and clear, though. But usually they're at a crosswalk. So it makes the distance across the longer road. You can see where they added that in. It makes the distance across the longer road shorter. Yep, quicker to get across, safer. Can you advance that? This is an example of a median island. Just gives a pedestrian a refuge halfway across the street. Curb cut ramps. Many of our streets have them already, but it's just another component. I think it's working now. Sharrows and bike lanes. Sharrow is a new symbol. West Salem should be the first ones to have them in 2012 on the Garland Street portion of their SDP urban program. It just designates, you know, sort of this lane is to be shared by cars and bikes. Shared bike and parking lanes and bus transit stops. Paved shoulders, also a part of complete streets. They just allow people to walk, allow bikes to ride safely. And in rural settings, a 14-foot travel lane constitutes a complete street. So we have many, many complete streets in the county already, but in the future we could make more. So this is a map that shows, this is kind of why the health department takes interest in this now. This is a map that shows the increasing obesity rates throughout the United States. So the light blue is 10% of the population is over 30 pounds or over a BMI of 30. And then dark blue is 15 to 19. I can go back there. So you can see that we're in the 20 to 29% category, and there's new colors being introduced all the time. So it's a growing problem. What this means for healthcare dollars in the United States, we spend $147 billion annually on healthcare costs related to obesity. In Wisconsin, we spend $1.5 billion annually, which is projected to increase to $6.7 by 2018. And just on average, obese adults incur $1,429 extra dollars per year in healthcare. So just some quick math. If you take that 1429 number times our population and our obesity rate, you get a number of $42 million. So what that means is healthcare costs related to obesity in La Crosse County are $42 million additionally. Roughly 50% of that is paid for by Medicare and Medicaid, so $21 million in La Crosse County. So for each man, woman, and child in La Crosse County, that would be about $185. And how this affects children. Children are not immune from the obesity epidemic. One-third of our nation's children are overweight or obese. Limited physical activity contributes to the obesity epidemic. And streets that provide dedicated space for biking and walking help kids to be physically active. Today's children, this was an article from the New England Journal of Medicine, stated that today's children are likely to be the first generation to have a shorter lifespan than their parents. Now, we all understand that we all have a personal responsibility to exercise, maintain our health, eat well, but if this is out your front door, you're going to be less encouraged to walk across that street, walk down that street, and be physically active. Here's a couple studies that sort of back this up. People that live in neighborhoods with complete streets are more likely to be active and less likely to be obese. this shows obesity rates in the United States compared to other countries. So in the United States, in the United States, we're up around 25% obesity. And in Switzerland, Netherlands, Denmark, they're down in the teens. And the green line shows the amount of people biking and walking. So you can see in the United States, we're on the far left. We're at about 5, whereas other countries are 55, 56, somewhere around there. I'm having pointer troubles again. Can you advance it, Jenny? Thank you. The CDC recommends that we adopt complete streets policies to prevent obesity. Build it and they will walk or ride. Residents are more likely to walk in a neighborhood with sidewalks and more likely to ride a bike if they have bike lanes. That makes sense to all of us. This is the safety aspects of complete streets. Complete streets are going to be safer streets because auto pedestrian crashes are twice as likely to occur in places without sidewalks, and bicycle accommodations reduce crash rates by 50%. From 2000 to 2008 in La Crosse County, we had 679 bicycle pedestrian accidents and 9 fatalities. In 2008, La Crosse metro area had the highest pedestrian fatality rate at 27%. So this complete streets concept will improve safety for everyone, not just bicyclists, not just pedestrians. It'll make things safer for motorists too, for people using wheelchair, for seniors, for transit users. Safe routes to school. Complete streets create safe routes to school in the future. Pedestrian injury is the leading cause of death for children aged 5 to 14. The potential saving from hazardous busing, which would be eliminated if there was complete streets. In some of our smaller cities and towns, children are bused, less than 2 blocks. So complete streets are looking to the future. It could take 10 to 15 years to make a complete streets network, but Safe Routes to School concentrates on the school environment around schools to fix it right now. So complete streets have been adopted at the federal level. We do now have a state law, a complete streets state law. They are recommended by the CDC, the National Institute of Health, the La Crosse County Roadway Plan, and the Strategic Plan for Sustainability. The Secretary of Transportation, here's a quote from him. He says, "It turns out the complete streets approach offers a perfect intersection of my twin guideposts, safety, and livable communities." The DOT wrote a policy statement just sort of suggesting that governments, professional associations, community organizations, and other government agencies adopt similar policies to statements on bicycle and pedestrian accommodations. So the federal government backs it up, and they also tie their funding to it, and I'll explain that in the next couple slides. So what Complete Streets will do is direct planners, designers, engineers, public works personnel to design better roadway plans, which are eligible for more federal, state, and transportation enhancement money, which in turn makes safe, accommodating roadways, which cost less. So last year, in the state of Wisconsin, there was $6 million available for transportation enhancements. And the STP Urban Program, which is also in Wisconsin, had $67 million. Alaska was awarded $839,000 of that transportation enhancement. Their streetscape project included bicycle and pedestrian accommodations, sort of a revitalizing of their downtown. And they got nearly $1 billion to do that. West Salem applied in 2006 for this transportation enhancement money. Didn't receive it at that time. They added bicycle and pedestrian accommodations to the plan, reapplied in 2008, and they got $575,000 to redo their downtown pathways project. Here's some of our local supporters. They have all endorsed our campaign and think that this complete streets is a good idea. complete streets costs. Now, if this is taken into account in the initial design phase, complete streets cost little more than incomplete streets. Where complete streets can save money is when later retrofits are needed to make the streets or roads or bridges safe, like the Clinton Street Bridge. A great deal of our Safe Roads to School infrastructure grants are to make things safe that were not originally built to standards. So we know how to build these roads right. They're not too hard to build right. It doesn't cost that much more to build them correctly. This is a good example of a road that accommodates bicyclists, pedestrians, cars, transit, everyone involved there. But for some reason, we still get these type of roads, six-lane roads that don't accommodate anybody except for cars. And this. And there's a pedestrian there crossing. There's houses over here and then retail on the right. So it kind of makes a difficult situation for pedestrians. Here's an example of a road from Milwaukee. That's the Bradley Tower there. It's just an artist's rendition of a complete street on the right side. But that's how it can look. And you can see there's bike lanes there. There's crosswalks. There's bump outs. They even have some trees to make things look nice. So I'll just go through some before and afters quickly and let you have a look at them. This is just an example of how it can look afterwards. There's the before and after. Here's a road from Boulder, Colorado. You can see that there's deteriorated shoulder, and this has bike lanes and median islands for crosswalks. Here's one of a classic road diet. This is a four-lane road, which they cut down to a two-lane with a turn lane and bike parking, or parking and bike lanes. And that's all just with paint. They probably resurfaced the road, but that's not necessarily a part of it. And you can see that there. Here's one of a major city, just an urban example. You can see there's many crosswalks there. It still looks like pretty pedestrian friendly, but in the second picture, you can see that they've made more median islands, more crosswalks, bike lanes. So what if more of our roads in cities and towns could look a little bit more like this? And what you see there is bike lanes, marked crosswalks, median islands, narrow travel lanes, sharrows, visible signs, ADA accessible ramps, bike lanes. So in summary, complete streets has the possibility to decrease obesity rates and save money, improve safety for everyone, create safe routes to school, sell La Crosse to the best and brightest young people, and save La Crosse money when safety improvements are required. What questions do you have for me?
Anybody have any questions? You did a good job. No questions. Oh, we do have one. Andrea Richmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How much money is available for redoing our streets in La Crosse?
Well, the transportation enhancement, as of right now, this might all change the next year, but you can see it was $6 million per year. And then the STP Urban Program, which is another surface transportation program, that's $67 million. And both those prioritize that you have bicycle and pedestrian accommodations included in there. So as far as the total number, that's federal and state money. Now, 53% of roads built in Wisconsin are built with local funds, too.
Right.
That's why it's important to have a policy that sort of addresses that.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Ray Ebert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, and maybe you were one of the other folks, how do you know if this money we spent was a success? What kind of a criteria do you say, geez, we were successful, or no, we weren't? What's your benchmarks?
Well, for my position, I'll just speak for my position. It's the the adoption of policies in La Crosse, the city of La Crosse County, Holman, Alaska. So that's part of my job, to have those adopted. That's how they gauge success for me. It's different for everyone else, but there's some other things along the way too. Like, we want to increase the number of people biking to work by 10%, and we want to have 15 businesses participating in the active commuting program. So I can speak for myself. I don't know if you want to hear from anyone else or from Linda.
There is an evaluation for everything. Every part of what you saw tonight has an evaluation. We have baseline data that we started with, counting the number of kids walking and biking to school. Jack, this fall, did a bike count of the number of people biking on certain roads at certain times of day. We, for the farm to school piece, we have baseline data of what the schools actually, how much local produce they were using prior to what, you know, the program we're running. And then we actually did a plate waste study this fall to look at, okay, we served squash, how much of it was taken and how much of it was eaten. We actually have photos if you want to see them. So each of the components has an evaluation component to it, because we think that's really important, that, you know, we're spending taxpayer money and we want to make sure that what we do matters, that it makes a difference.
And this was a two-year program?
It was a two-year program.
And then I assume that when this is over, you'll come back with us and give us those benchmarks?
Yeah.
I think that's the, you know, again, we spend stuff and we really a lot of times don't know if it worked. So I thank you that you have that type of a thing to assess it. Thank you.
Yeah.
Other questions? All right. Thank you all very much. Appreciate it.
I just want to comment. I've been going to a lot of basketball games of 9 and 13 and 11-year-olds, and I'm just amazed at how many of the kids who are playing basketball are really heavy, you know. And their parents, the parents of the kids that I'm observing who are related to me, they did walk to school, and they played basketball too. But it's amazing. If you go and you just look around.
Yeah.
And I just think that we we have to keep promoting this. We have to make it easier for our kids to ride their bikes. We have to make it easier for them to get to school. And if they live only a mile from school, maybe they should walk, even if a bus would pick them up.
both ways uphill. Tara,
At Longfellow Middle School, sixth graders at least have an activity requirement every day as part of their curriculum. Is that part of this initiative as well, or is that something that they just are doing independently? Okay.
They're not a safe route to school.
Thank you.
Maureen Friedland.
Since Mr. Ebert is from West Salem, I thought I would add the comment that the West Salem businesses are benefiting, I believe, by the improvements that they've made. That strip, Garland Avenue, has become very popular with people from La Crosse. And on Tuesday mornings, there's a group of women, if anybody wants to join us on the county board, we ride up there, we stop at a couple restaurants there, and we end at Linda's Bakery. on balance, I think it's okay, but check with Linda's Bakery to see how their business has increased on Tuesday mornings.
Jill Billings.
I have a quick question about the farm to school program. I'm wondering if that's done in any of the high schools.
Unfortunately, we're not in high schools right now as part of this grant. Although I will say that much of the food products that we end up sending into the schools end up at the high schools. And in fact, the high schools have some extra flexibility to serve some things that might be out of the price range to elementary schools, because they're able to serve a la carte items. kind of like a, you know, pay for one thing kind of aspect. But given the very, very short time frame for this grant and the emphasis that we have on changing as many behaviors as possible in a short amount of time, we decided to focus on elementary school kids, third graders specifically, to have the biggest long-term impact, because of the fact that even by the time you get to high school, kids' opinions about the foods that are eating have already become fairly entrenched. And we see, for example, I'm not sure exactly who has an open campus and who doesn't in the high schools, but with all of the options that the high school kids have, we thought that it would be a better use of our time and the dollars for this grant to focus on a little bit more of a captive audience and one that was a little bit more impressionable, which is why we went with elementary school kids. But I know that all of the district food service directors that we're working with are very excited about expanding this, both, I guess that's within the context of the nutrition education materials that are going out. They want to get that into the high schools as well. Very often the food products end up on the lunch lines, but whether or not they're really heavily promoted once they're there is, we're focusing on the promotion aspect in the elementary schools.
Dandina.
I guess I have a question for you too, as long as you're by the microphone. Years ago, we tried to do some of this, and I chaired the Catholic Rural Life Committee for the Diocese of La Crosse, and we tried to get into the Catholic schools at that point in time. Organic was just coming on the scenes, and we were told, I got two letters in my file from the distributors at that point in time, that if you supply that food in the summertime, we're not going to deliver in the wintertime. And so have you run into anything like that yet?
You know, the distributors, it's been one of the great pleasures that I've had working in the position that I'm in, is that the distributors we have, and we there are a great number of food distributors both in La Crosse and in the area. Everyone is very, very excited to be a part of this. Just this last month, March, our March Farm to School item was a small Wisconsin-grown red potato that went out to the schools, and Reinhardt distributed it. And we've been working together very closely. Jolivet Family Farms out in West Salem has been a big, enormous amount of support in terms of solving logistical issues that, frankly, not many of us are capable of solving, either at the farm end or within the school food service staff or myself at the county. That's not our forte, let's say. Yeah. And I really think that the resources are in place, that the distributors and the folks who are in charge of putting product on trucks and getting it to the end users, that they're very much a part of the partnership that's going to make this work in the long term.
That's good to hear, because this was years ago, so they must have changed their mind a little bit on it, because they could see it coming probably. So.
Yeah, and I mean the big challenge for them now is just the seasonality aspect, is how do you have the summer products delivered in the winter? And we're working on that with some processing and freezing. But they're very much on board and a big. I certainly couldn't do it. None of us, I think, could do it without the without those folks, the Reinhardts and the Jolivets and the Fox Rivers.
Again, thank you very much. Thank Appreciate you. Your report, and look forward to your reporting back to us later.
Thank you, and also a bike club from La Crosse left you some information. Also, thanks.
Thank you.
And the final wrap-up to that, just a reminder, the three committees I mentioned, PRD, Public Works, and, of course, Health and Human Services will receive resolution policy recommendations on complete streets. There's a team of folks, including our new highway commissioner and his staff, Linda Lee and Jack from Health and Human Services, as well as Charlie Handy from Planning. So we're all coordinating what the items are that are involved in what a complete streets policy might look like for the county. And so it'll come back through your April cycle and get your direction and input as we develop that further. So just keep that in mind, because we're helping to lead the effort and discussion, hopefully that the cities and villages and other local governments will end up looking at some of the things that we talked about, as well as the LAPC Metropolitan Planning Organization will be involved in these discussions as well. So keep your eyes peeled for that information as it comes through. I saw another hand, Mr. Chair.
Margaret Wood.
Thank you. Since I think we're at the end of this part of our agenda, I just really want to recognize the industriousness, the flexibility, and the vision of our health department, and I think you're a fine example of La Crosse County employees. Thank you very much.
Jeff Schrader.
I assume this is a grant process they have to go through to do this?
It is a grant. We got $2.2 million last March, and we have until March of 2012 to get our plan of work done. So what you heard tonight was we're in the midst of getting that work accomplished. We're hoping that pieces of it will be refunded down the road, but there's no guarantees. So we have money to do the work we want to do until March 2012.
And on the topic of funding in the future, that gets us, great segue, thank you, Linda, into the report on the impact of the governor's budget proposal. How do you like that for moving us over?
Okay, as you can expect, I have a presentation that I'll end up going through in a moment, but or in a little bit of time. I just want to quickly summarize, and then I'm going to actually bring up a couple of other folks to give you more details, because quite often you hear enough from me. Most of the cuts we've been able to identify so far from the governor's budget are in 2012. There are significant major impacts to clients and community members in a number of issues, and I think that's what I want to highlight before I actually go into my presentation. Recognize that over the next several weeks, a lot of this is going to become clearer. It's over a 1,345-page bill. All of the various associations that represent services within county government are deeply analyzing this. A lot of it is put together very quickly in the budget document, and a lot of lack of clarity in what's in the budget document is still coming to the forefront. Changes will have to be made because at times there were things put in there that weren't clear and that the administration has said that they need to change or need to clarify. Again, this is filtering through right now, but everything from the Legislative Fiscal Bureau to Wisconsin Counties Association and each of the associations of professional departments are going back through and actually analyzing this. What's disappointing is that major portions of the budget just continue past practices of the state shifting responsibilities to counties without additional funding, actually cutting back on funding, without eliminating the responsibilities that we've had, major items that are in there, and that even though most of the dollar cuts to us will be 2012 and 2013, and we'll end up wrestling with those in our budget deliberations, that's probably the best news out of it. There are significant financial impacts to our community and to departments that serve our most needy within our community right now. So rather than start to go into my presentation, if we have time, I will end up doing mine, but there are two major areas that I wanted to touch on that you as the representatives of the public, I think you need to understand and hear about as we learn about that. So very quickly, I'm going to ask Doreen Holmes-Krowski to stop up, and she's got some information about the impact on elderly services. She doesn't have a full presentation, but she does some handouts that I'm going to help her distribute, or if Doug could help just a second while I finish talking and introducing her. She's been very involved in monitoring what's happening to our elderly community, and particularly in areas of transportation and those types of things. As you know, Noreen heads our aging department, and then probably the biggest impact will be a presentation that I'm going to ask Jason and Dean and their staff to present on the income impact to income maintenance and economic support. So with that, I just asked Noreen to review with you the information she's handing out now, because we want you to go away with some information of understanding the complexity and impact on some of our elderly community and some of the things that are happening right now. So, Noreen.
Thank you. You should all receive one color handout that talks about transit. That includes MTU transportation and elderly and disabled transportation and even other types of transportation. That's significant because as part of the governor's budget, there is movement to move elderly and disabled transportation, you may know that as 8521, from the Department of Transportation, the DOT, over to Human Services, where elderly and disabled transportation could then compete with all the other programs that there's no funding for already. Many people look at that as a way to kill the program, so we could end up with no elderly and disabled transportation. So why would that be so significant? A lot of people end up, because of physical reasons or just by choice, they don't drive anymore. But they still have the need to go to the grocery store, to go to the doctor, to visit their spouse in a nursing home, to visit their children, to go out to the mall and go shopping. And that keeps people active in the community, mentally active, and also healthy. If people end up in their homes and they don't drive, they become isolated in their homes. And if they need services, that can also mean they can't get to the doctor, they can't get the things they need to stay in their home, they end up actually going into nursing homes or assisted living prematurely. That could cost as much as $60,000 or $70,000 a year for an individual. But if you multiply that times 100 people, that would be $6 to $7 million in cost. Some people may be able to pay their own way. I would guess that anyone paying $60,000 or $70,000 a year can't pay their own way for any too long before they would end up on a system where the taxpayers pay. At the same time as we look at these challenges for elderly and disabled transportation, Wisconsin is set to lose $46.6 million in federal funding for transit due to collective bargaining being eliminated. They will also lose federal capital assistance, which also requires collective bargaining. So for La Crosse MTU, that would be about $2 million in cuts, according to Keith Carlson from the MTU. That would cause severe, large cuts in service and increases in fares. So not a good climate for transportation. Additionally, for the senior population, we are looking at requirements for senior care to be people who would be on senior care, which is a very popular prescription drug program. Seniors like it because it's easier to understand than Medicare Part D. You can actually get your arms around it. You know, you pay $5 for generic or $15 for non-generic prescriptions, and you have a spend down if you make too much money. Senior care is used as credible service, and it's also used as an insurance policy for those on Medicare Part D. Medicare Part D has formularies. Certain drugs are covered. Certain drugs are not covered. You pay a monthly premium for most Medicare Part D policies. For senior care, you pay $30 a year. 92,000 seniors are on senior care in this state. The way that it's being proposed by Governor Walker, it would probably cease to exist in about a year and a half because it would no longer be relevant. People wouldn't, if they're forced to go on Medicare Part D, for the most part, there wouldn't be a need for them to also be on senior care. The homestead tax credit is frozen. Maybe you have an elderly mom or dad or neighbor or relative that you've helped fill out their homestead tax credit. This is something that helps seniors adjust for inflation. There's no COLA increase for the last 2 years. There's no increase in Social Security based on cost of living. So for seniors who are on a fixed income, that means their income is static, but they pay the same increases we all do for gasoline, for heating their homes, for food, which we expect to see some big increases coming. So I think that it's unfortunate that at the same time we freeze the homestead tax credit. The Elderly Benefit Specialist Program in the aging unit helps seniors decide which Medicare Part D plan will work the best for them, supplemental insurance advice they give, Medicare advice, senior care, Social Security, and even consumer issues. Over the years, we track how much they save for La Crosse County residents. That is a number that is between 800,000 and 900,000 a year. Their services are very important to seniors, and many seniors don't make a move without checking with Tina, and that includes my mom. When I tell her what she needs to do, she always says, well, what does Tina say? And so she has a really nice way about her, and she helps so many people. Short-term savings that we see coming in this budget that actually increase long-term care costs really don't amount to savings, in my interpretation. And we all know our society is getting older. Those 60 years old and older, the number of older folks in our population will double within 20 years. So it seems to me we're already seeing those increases in the aging unit. It seems to be really not a very good time to start decreasing services to seniors.
Dan Vina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I sit on the Transportation Coordinating Committee, and over the years we have developed new routes all the way from La Crescent to Vernon, Jackson County. Now we have a couple new routes coming on in Vernon County. What is the status going to be for those routes that transport the elderly to and from hospitals and clinics and you name it?
Well, it depends on who's paying for that. My guess is it's primarily 8521 elderly and disabled transportation, so they would be at risk.
Is that staying or is that going away?
We have contracts for 2011. Unclear what's happening in this budget. All of the organizations that are transit friendly, for instance, WRTA, Wisconsin Rural and Urban Transit Association, everyone is still reading the bills and trying to determine what the actual impact will be. But in addition to that, part of the Vernon County routes are through the STRAP grant. We have STRAP funding through 2011, and that's it. STRAP funding is also going to be affected by the collective bargaining clause. Those are federal programs, so we have to sign assurances for what kind of, you know, that kind of climate we have for people who deliver that service, and collective bargaining is required for federal contracts.
I talked to a person the other day who knows quite a bit about transportation, and he told me that the aides in some cases are going to be based on whether you're union or non-union, and I really have a problem with that, and I need that answer on the 11th of March.
It's collective bargaining. That's the problem, which is part of union contracts. So that could be why they're calling it union, but it's based on collective bargaining.
Any other questions for Noreen? Dan Ferries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Around the first of the year, or shortly before that, I had the opportunity. I got approached about assisting at the nutrition centers. And I got to admit, it took a little arm twisting at first. I didn't go willingly. But I jumped in, and I've been doing it since then. And, a lot of times, helping out the seniors like this, it's so rewarding. You may be the only individual that they see all day long because of being shut-ins. It might be the only warm meal they get all day. So, and I see with potential cuts here, and I believe that volunteers do run short, and you have to hire staff to deliver meals. So I would, if you really want something rewarding, to the county board here, get out. And I know we get meetinged out sometimes at the end of the month, but I really encourage people to take advantage of this and participate in this and volunteer. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? All right, Noreen, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, as I mentioned, next, Jason Witt and his staff have a presentation on probably the most significant change. As you can imagine, Human Services is probably the most complex set of programs, services, and categorical aids throughout the budget. It's probably the most complicated to actually acknowledge and be able to figure out all the detail impacts. But particularly in income maintenance, there is a major proposal to change very quickly the current way that income maintenance and economic support is provided in the state, and it's very troubling given the populations that we serve. So I'm just going to turn it over to Jason.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. I was going to talk about today, there are several actual proposals in the governor's budget that impact human services. We're going to talk about two of those tonight, income maintenance and family care. Income maintenance, because that has the potential to have the greatest impact on human services populations and the people that we serve, and family care because of the long tradition here in La Crosse and really in family care and being one of the pilot counties from family care, and what the budget does in that area is really turn away from one of the key tenets of family care. I do want to acknowledge Dean Rupert, our operations director, is going to help present the portion with regards to family care. Lori Graff is our economic support section manager, is here with us tonight, and we have a lot of staff from economic support that's here with us tonight as well. Okay, the provision with regards to income maintenance is the following is listed in the governor's executive budget summary, that the governor is recommending transferring the administration of income maintenance from counties and tribes to the state. And there are some complexities for this, and you'll be hearing a lot about this, I would imagine, in the coming weeks. So to get a full flavor of that, was going through the presentation answering the following four questions in terms of going over what income maintenance programs are, what duties our staff in the county currently perform with regards to those services, what happens and is changing under the governor's budget proposal, and what reasons are there to be concerned about that. In terms of what are income maintenance programs, and as listed in the governor's executive budget summary, it lists changes in all three of these program areas. The first is food share, which is really what's commonly referred to as food stamps. And that helps people that really can't afford food or nutrition for their kids get that. And we have about 11,000 individuals in the county that are on that benefit. And really the next stop for this population, if they do not receive that benefit, is often the food pantry. Then we have medical assistance, which provides access to health care for those who would not otherwise afford it. And really we're going at there, making sure people can have access to medical care on either preventive needs or early intervention, so we avoid the very costly items if they end up in the emergency room, whether it's for a medical health reason, but also mental health. And we receive a lot of funding offsets in our mental health and recovery section from clients who are MA eligible. Also, there is Badger Care, and that's a health insurance program started by Governor Tommy Thompson, which the purpose was to provide health care coverage to some of the citizens of Wisconsin who did not currently receive that through their employers. And in terms of the amount of recipients, you see 11,000, just about 12,000 for food share, about 6,000 for medical assistance, 12,000 for Badger Care. If we're some of those are duplicated, which we could have folks in each category, but if we look at the unduplicated count, 18,000 of our neighbors here in La Crosse County receiving some form of assistance under this, really over 1 in 10 individuals in La Crosse County impacted by these benefits. That's why when we're talking about changes in this area, it's such a big deal. In terms of duties the county currently performs here, we have the Economic Support Services section, which is the one of the five service sections in Human Services. And we have Family and Children, Mental Health Recovery, Chemical Health and Justice Sanctions, Economic Support Services, and the Aging and Disability Resource Center. So it's economic support that performs functions in this area. And in that section, we have 36 staff, and really 26 of those staff are really related to administration of income maintenance programs. The functions that those workers perform, they interview clients for eligibility for the programs. Actually, the voice on the other end of the phone that people hear when they call in are the people that they meet with when they come into our office. They interview those applicants for eligibility, assist clients with the completing applications, which is a very technical process, determine eligibility, and there is just a ton of different ever-changing eligibility requirements for these programs that our workers are up to date on, and then regularly reassessing for eligibility as those clients' needs and circumstances change. Three things that are really the focus there: to provide good customer service, to make sure those determinations are made timely. Again, when you're talking about folks that can't afford food, it's very important to do those and process those timely. And also making sure they are accurate in terms of meeting the eligibility requirements. There are penalties to be had if we're not accurate in that area. Also, just to note, the workers performing this function at the county level are certified income maintenance workers, and that certification takes place under federal criteria. And these workers have enormous caseloads. Caseload sizes can range from 4 to 600 per worker to keep track of, and all those changes in that area. In terms of the job we've done here, we've really done a good job in La Crosse, and we get the job done in this area. This is not a system or a function that is broken by any stretch of the imagination. For our recognition we've received, we have 100% rates for payment accuracy and timely application for federal fiscal years 2009 and in 2010. We recently had a quality service review of W-2, which is not part of this, but is tied in with income maintenance, which was overwhelmingly positive and really noted the good integration that we have with our child welfare caseload, and that integration with other service areas is very important because we also, usually if we have someone in child welfare, they also have income maintenance needs, they may have mental health needs, best practice calls for good integration there. And we also have received numerous awards in recognition for our work. And I would invite you, I see actually some of our workers brought some of the awards that we've received over the past years here. Would encourage you to take a look and talk to them about those. So in terms of what's happening under the governor's budget proposal, the proposal itself is a cost-saving proposal. It is estimated they would like to save $48 million statewide in this area and decrease staff overall by 270 positions. And those positions would mainly come from the county in terms of those 270 positions. And I definitely do want to caveat here, we are finding out more about this proposal and how it fully impacts IM. It is clear that IM is being transferred to the state under the proposal. How far it goes, there's a bit of unclarity and clarity in that at this time, so I do want to say that. So what it does, first, in terms of the cost efficiency partnership that's currently in place with La Crosse County is being abandoned. And what that is, we've been working with the state over the last year in a pilot and working to really decrease costs in this area. We have 8 counties we are in partner with, but we have a regional change center here in La Crosse. And what that change center does is take calls that are when someone's already on assistance but has a change in circumstances. That unit processes those changes centrally for all of the counties listed there. The idea is that if you combine like this in a regional way, you can do the same job in a specialized way with less staff. For a number of years, this has been the way that the state has gone in terms of reducing costs in the IM area. And we were proud to be a forerunner and pilot county with that, but unfortunately, that is canceled under the governor's budget. Next, the statewide administration of IM is being mostly privatized and centralized with an increased reliance on automation. So for automation, could include document scanning and making it the whole process less paper intensive, and also doing applications through the internet, through kiosks, which works in some cases, but honestly tends to be pretty difficult from some of the populations that we serve in the mental health and in other areas. But the specifics of that, which are still coming into view a bit, is really, it's clear in the budget, a new state income maintenance unit is created at the state level, and the state workforce there being expanded by about 131 new positions. Those positions, as far as we know, will be in Madison. In addition, there's up to 1,000 new positions being added, but they're being contracted through HP Enterprise Services, it looks like, so it's a contract vendor. And that's the current vendor that does central processing for the administration of Badger Care Core. So a portion of IM is already semi-privatized under this model. This really expands it to take over all of income maintenance. It appears that of all of these new, whether it's new contract or state staff, few would be deployed locally, so we'd see few back here in La Crosse. Most of it would be centralized, and there may be a few workers here to assist clients, but it's really a very rigid, centralized model. And how that model seems to work is you'd have the contract staff that would not be IM certified, but would just gather and process information, then would be sent along to that state unit that's central, and they would be IM certified. So you're taking a lot of this, privatizing it from higher skilled certified workers to lower skilled non-certified workers under this plan. So what that would mean, depending on how far this goes in terms of food share and medical assistance, up to 26 positions that the county has to perform this function could become obsolete. Now, that number could be anywhere from half a dozen to 26, again, depending on how far the state goes with the function. And also, county funding allocations for IM are being discontinued, and county overmatch is being seized. So what I mean by that is currently we receive a allocation from the state to perform IM services. That allocation is about $900,000. But like many of the programs in the human services area, I don't know if it's fair to call them unfunded mandates, but it's certainly fair to call them underfunded mandates because the funding we receive does not cover the full cost it takes to perform the service. Especially counties like La Crosse want to put extra money in to make sure we're getting it right. So we have the $900,000 IM allocation, and we have an additional $115,000 of county funds that we put in there to make sure we fund the operation correctly and can meet our targets there. But unfortunately, we're not being rewarded by putting in that extra funding. The state in this is taking back their IM allocation and our county funding allocation overmatch as well. So that disappears. So how that happens, they can't come in and seize county tax levy, but what they can do is decrease the amount of our community aids basic county allocation. So that's the mechanism that would be used here to seize those funds. Now that actually, in terms of cost of the county, would be a wash because we're using all that to fund operations, and those operations would disappear and the money would disappear. So in terms of being short in other areas, again, we wouldn't, that would be a wash, except for the fact there's about $143,000 in revenue we get because we're able to charge off in indirect administrative costs from the county and get that back. Now that would be revenue we would then be short and have to make up other areas, and that's about $143,000 when we look at the entirety, which is federal reimbursement. That's correct. Okay, in terms of this area, in terms of reasons for concern, One is just the potential loss of jobs in terms of what that means to the local economy here. In terms of the ramp up schedule of this, we've got some indication of what that is at least preliminarily looking at like. On July 1st, the state is looking at taking over data processing functions, and that could include two positions that would be impacted in terms of becoming obsolete because the state's taking that over on July 1st. On October 1st, then the state starts a change center, kind of like the change center we currently operate under pilot. That would impact all of those change center employees. That's about eight positions in October. And then February through May is when they ramp up to do the full application and processing, and that could impact, and again, which pieces they take of this, but it would be really odd if they just took a piece of it because they really all kind of go hand in hand together, and it doesn't seem like it would make sense to have two change centers for two different benefits. But that could be up to 16 additional employees for a net total positions impacted of 26 or more. Besides the job loss, there is the issue in terms of local accountability. This is a very technical function, and again, if clients don't receive their determinations timely, of course they're upset about that. Well, now if they're upset about that and something's not functioning, it's not hard to know where to go. Upstairs in the same office to my office is one place to go. To any of the county board supervisors is a good place to go. But there's a really direct and local accountability if something's not functioning there. We would lose that, and when that wasn't done timely, we'd have to go to the state. And the experience from the Badger Care Corps takeover, that process isn't very, very responsive. And we experience that as a department as well. We've been trying to work with our main program contact in the IM area and have been sending emails and phone calls for the last 3 months and haven't been able to get a response. So there is, unfortunately, a notorious lack of kind of accountability and ability to get answers from the state, and that would could suffer under this. Also, there's a risk that the state will not be able to deliver on this. And although they're saying they're taking over the function under a very aggressive timeline, experiments in this area have been problematic. And with that, what we wouldn't want to happen is what happened in Milwaukee County. And that's where before the department, actually, this is where the state came in and took over the IM administration because the county was doing the job ineffectively. And there you had only a 1 in 100 chance that a call would be answered and a 1 in 5 chance that the food share benefits would be cut off mistakenly. The program had been so neglected there that the state came over and took over the program. But certainly not to spread blame from one administration to the other. When the state took over the program, still was dysfunctional and very dysfunctional for quite a period of time. And what happened in Milwaukee, they had thousands of folks who had to wait months for food stamp benefits, waited in long lines at the food pantries. Talked about the feds came and said, you know, you have one of the worst backlogs in the country in this area. And again, this was after the state takeover under a similar model. And the feds were threatening sanctions in terms of penalties. And again, applications waits of more than 1 hour. Now, the state has made progress last in terms of clearing up that backlog of cases, but the feds are still concerned that it hasn't been enough. There's still progress that's needed there, and there was some issue with the legality of having a private firm and what exactly a private firm could handle in that area. But what we're concerned about is that the issues in terms of the state model and in centralization don't appear to be limited to the experience in Milwaukee. Those experiences seem to be consistent with what our workers have been seeing regarding the current state administration of the Badger Care benefits. And what's been disappointing on that, that's been an area where the state said we're going to take over this function, but for so long has been relying, then it has to come back to the county, and actually I believe it has paid us some money because they continue to rely on our staff to really bail them out in this area and do the job, and it's been hard for our staff to see. We've seen clients wait for up to 3 hours on hold and their cell phones go dead. Where do you go for benefits? It really has been a bit of a disaster in terms of client interaction with that program there. But besides Milwaukee, it doesn't seem to be limited to the state either in terms of models in this area. Indiana did a similar model where they used call centers, document imaging, and this automation process, and are being levied a $1.2 million penalty because not being timely or accurate in terms of making the determinations there. Also, the state of Texas experimented in this area, privatized their service, and has been called the state's biggest privatization fiasco in that state's history. And there's still problems that persist with that model there. And we are really concerned in terms of what would happen to the clients in the interim. Certainly don't mean to be saying now that the state, this may be the administration that figured this out, can go hit the ground running and get this right. But there are a lot of risks if they don't. And what's disappointing, this really goes away from a model that's been followed by previous administrations, Democrat and Republican alike, where that if you're going to make a radical change like this, like family care was a radical change, like alternative response in CPS was a radical change, you would do it a little slower. You would pilot it first, make sure it works, and slowly expand it. Unfortunately, what's going on here between now and next May, it's just going full-blown, and you know, hopefully it'll work out, but again, there are a lot of consequences if it don't. It doesn't seem to be very well thought out, and it seems to be a very abrupt attempt at privatization. There's also the impact of fragmenting these services in terms of what that means for good business models and good program models. Currently, our economic support services section and those eligibility determinations are in the same department, are in the same building as mental health recovery, family and children, chemical health. So we literally sometimes walk clients across the hallway in order to help them sign up for benefits. It's very difficult for a mental health client to really navigate the system, the applications, or even have the trust with somebody to be able to access those benefits. To be able to have the unit on site and integrated means we're able to connect a lot of folks to services that otherwise wouldn't be connected to those services. And again, you never have a client in any one of these sections that just have one issue. There's usually a lot of multi-systemic issues that are going on. And like in the families and children, being able to properly provide for children sometimes depends on getting economic support benefits, and we're able to do this in an integrated way. But also, when we have that type of integration, what happens as well, we get that service access, but once we get the clients connected to MA benefits, we get that revenue back to help offset some of our services there. And that is really a big portion of our clients. If we look at clients in our mental health area, approximately 40% of La Crosse mental health clients currently have MA coverage. And we don't have an exact figure, but a lot of that's due to the hard work that we have been able to just walk across the hall and help folks with that benefits and work closely with our economic support section, which is right on site there. So besides the fragmentation, finally, the opportunity costs to La Crosse County of not having on the table, or at least pursuing, equally effective cost-saving approaches. And that's an approach like regionalization, like the Change Center. The Change Center experiences that we've had, we were just ready, actually, and still may sign contracts to this effect, but as of July 1st, to go live where we're off of seed money and having the other other seven counties contribute to that center. And with that, we stand to lose out on at least $50,000 or more annually of administrative costs that would be reimbursed by that. Also, a lot of the automation depends on a pretty sophisticated IT system. Our IT department has done an excellent job in terms of setting us up, keeping our systems current, and I may add a lot less costly than the 100-plus per hour rate of the state vendor in this area, Deloitte Touche, who hasn't been able to deliver to effectively fix the care system that our staff have to actually do workarounds to. So they haven't gotten that job done, and they're very expensive. We seem to do a better and cheaper job here. And unfortunately, we lose the ability to be entrepreneurial, to be able to try new things, having different experiments going around the state, regionally, to be able to borrow from other good ideas. Instead, you really go to a very government centralized, rigid sort of a model there. And probably one of a concern as well that we would have would be a final concern in terms of what would happen if there are legal challenges to this as well. There may be legal issues in terms of whether the RFP is done correctly in terms of the service provider, which it seems it's just being handed to the current provider, but whether there may be legality issues around that. And if they're not able to execute this and there's legal issues there, what gets caught in the middle is all these clients where we no longer have the structure to have good benefits. It's going to be difficult to stop this once it gets started. So just in terms of summary in this area, things that are an impact on the county is the potential of 26 jobs, depending on the full scope of this, the $143,000 in loss in administrative allocation, losses in the future projected Change Center revenue and really taking away our ability to be creative and entrepreneurial in this area. And what is a big unknown is an undetermined amount of loss in client MA offsets because these clients won't be able to be hooked up in MA in the way that we're doing this currently. And that could be a significant item. So that's the summary in terms of the IM area. Dean Rupert was going to talk a little bit about family care and the changes in that area.
I'll speak to family care. It's not the first time I've spoken to you about family care. Over the years, as Jason said, we've invested in this heavily for a number of years in La Crosse County. And there's some proposed changes that we'll share with you this evening. Just to give you some background on family care entitlement, as of January 2011, there are 56 Wisconsin counties that are participating in family care. If you remember back some of history here, the promise for La Crosse for citizens who are eligible over age 65 or adults over age 18 who are developmentally disabled or physically disabled, no more waiting lists. And we went into family care many years ago. We had hundreds of people, of course, on waiting lists and was our biggest driver in making the decision to move forward with that pilot in La Crosse and four other counties. While we're in the governor's proposed budget, while reviewing a soon-to-be-released Legislative Audit Bureau study, the budget caps enrollment for the next 2 years at the number on the membership rosters as of June 30th of 11. Only as a result of attrition will new members be allowed to enroll. So no longer is an entitlement. It's only based upon the count on the rosters of that particular date, and people who come into services may go on a wait list if there's not enough attrition to keep up with the demand for services, which is a big change for our county. Per the governor's budget request, family care in the past 2 years has increased by 29 counties and 15,000 individuals without an adequate review of program effectiveness, and that's the reason they're putting the cap on and waiting for the Legislative Audit Bureau study, which should be done next month or two, take a look at the data. But they feel this uncontrolled growth and not enough data to show the significance of it, even though it's already in 56 counties. La Crosse was at full entitlement since April of 2002. So in a matter of a month, it would be 10 years that La Crosse already was at full entitlement, no waiting list in La Crosse County. A local managed care provider, as many of you know, is West Wisconsin Cares. WWC was a part of La Crosse County Human Service Department until it went to its own family care district, which we helped pilot and provided support to until October of 2008, and that time became its own district, and it's located with its main offices for eight counties up in this area. The enrollment data they provided to me this week say they have 3,362 enrollees from eight county area. Of these, about 2,000 La Crosse residents, were all 59% of that population. In 2010, our Aginess Resource Center, which has lots of functions, but one of their functions to enroll members into family care. They enrolled 474 members, which is about 40 persons a month just from La Crosse County. 298 of those members, or 63%, were from La Crosse, about 25 persons per month. Overall, eight county attrition for membership averaged about 38 per month. And of that, La Crosse County member attrition is typically about 23 a month. So the number of La Crosse residents who are going waitlist for long-term care services would equal an average of 2 per month. But you don't know what that's going to be and how that's going to affect individuals and the weight that they then would have until that happened. And that assumes that attrition is going to be by a county-by-county basis. We don't know, again, based upon the current information, if they'll do that regionally or it truly will be a county-by-county basis, because that numbers could change then. Our EDC is a four-county partnership beyond La Crosse, of course, which includes Vernon, Jackson, Monroe. And each of our ADC partners' counties, for them, we're supposed to reach full entitlement very soon. Vernon was going to reach full entitlement, which means, again, no waiting list. That was in November, Jackson, December, and Monroe, January of 2012. They still have 403 persons on their waiting list for services now that will not be able to get on because there won't be attrition, and they won't be at full entitlement prior to this taking effect, more than likely. So they'll continue waiting lists and will be able to enroll these individuals only as new referrals when attrition slots from their counties take place. So that's a quick overview of family care and where that potentially is heading and the impact it'll have upon our hospitals and ourselves and obviously citizenry in La Crosse County.
Dean, I'd like you to humanize that for us, if you will. Give an example of a person under the old system, what their particular affliction would be, what their care package would be under the old system, and how it works now and how that could change. So the people know the kind of client we're talking about here instead of just statistics.
Well, there's three types of clients. I'll just say, first of all, the persons who are frail elders have meet a certain level of care and financial requirements, typically indigent on Medicaid. They also have persons who are adult 18 and over who are development disabled, means mentally retarded, cerebral palsy, etc. And you have persons who are physically disabled, quadriplegics, individuals with physical issues as a result of aging or because of accident. So that's a general population served, but all of them have to be indigent, and you have to meet certain care level needs. But let's take a particular person who's their highest cost population in Western Wisconsin Cares, and in the past for us were persons who were development disabled. So let's take a person with significant mental retardation and issues that they have associated with that. Many of those individuals went through a special education program with the schools, typically would come into our system after being on a waiting list for up to 5 to 8 years because they had to wait because the schools were doing their part, would gradually have to graduate them at age 21 because you can keep to age 21, would decompensate typically in their family situation until that person either was court ordered to us, and of course we know the history of that with court orders that we had, or got eventually into services, be one of our Medicaid waiver programs, the old KIP-1A, KIP-1B, KIP-2, COP-W, all those acronyms that we had, and would receive services such as transportation, employment-related services, residential support services, respite care, and so on. The other thing they would utilize typically would in that maze would be their medical assistance card to get their medical care met, but also in many cases would get physical care through personal care programs and so on. When WWC came to being, it took all those long-term care programs, which we had 27 different programs, wrapped them into one, and said we'll give the care management organization one capitated rate, and you manage your caseload of individuals within the capitated rate, and they'll be known, and you'll be entitled to receive services if you're eligible. So what happened then is it basically brought care, what they say, under management, and a much closer look at coordination of systems and resources to make it more cost-effective for individuals with long-term care. So the same person may still receive those services and supports, but would do it through one funding stream and not a maze of funding streams or different people administering those programs and staff coming in that were being paid for by a host of provider services. So just quickly, it really uncomplicated the system and brought the care under management in order to make it effective.
Tara.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just add two pieces, or one piece, and then ask a question. The other shift to family care guided the whole delivery of care around member choice, that a member worked with a team, a social worker, a nurse, and whoever, whatever advocates they wanted at the table, to develop a care plan that the member chose for themselves. If they wanted, you know, I'm just oversimplifying, but if they needed transportation to get to a doctor's appointment, they could choose. If they needed in-home care to help supervise with medications or for personal hygiene, whatever it was, they could choose the provider that delivered those services. So one of the first tenet of family care is that there are member-centered plans that revolve around a member's choice for what services they need and who delivers them.
You're correct, Tara. It really removed the administration and decision-making from a case manager or a manager in our department saying you will or won't get it, to really the member and the team around them making those choices. Correct.
Right. Can I ask Dean a quick question?
Absolutely.
And also, from your reading of the lengthy budget document around family care, is there also a cap on the per member per month rate, or is that, has that been addressed in this budget?
I've not seen that. I still think that's still going to be actuarially determined, which, of course, is always under question how that's determined. But I've not seen that that's going to be capped.
It's just the enrollment cap.
Just the enrollment cap. Okay. That's what I've seen to date, at least.
Thank you.
One more clarification. Going to family care, did that cost us money or save us money?
Well, it took away the risk to the county, and it took away the need to put county levy in there, especially for the growing population. And Noreen mentioned the aging population of itself, and it's one of the fast-growing segments of society. We're not responsible for that any longer in terms of long-term care needs for them. So it did save county dollars, and it took away the long-term risk of serving that population that we would have had.
Thank you. Jill Billings.
I have a question about the waiting list. When we we started the pilot, we were assured that as people enter the program, and there were those long waiting lists, you talk about 403 people are still waiting from other counties, that La Crosse would not go on that list, that we would have prior, we'd be able to basically continue as we had been with no waiting list. Will that be changed under this new policy? Will we be? Will our two be thrown in behind the 403 that are already waiting, or will they have priority still?
That's yet to be determined. Reason being is that because we've been a four-county ADRC in managing this, we're one of two in the state been allowed to manage waiting lists with some discretion in terms of if it's county-based or geographically based. And so we have a hybrid model here. And so we're anticipating that we'd be allowed to continue so that the three partner counties would have their wait list blended, but La Crosse would be kept separate, which would be the best news for La Crosse because then we wouldn't have to be competing with those 403 persons, but we don't know yet if we'll be allowed to do that.
Bev Mack.
Explain to me how we got rid of our waiting lists. I don't quite understand that.
It's the same process that the other 56 counties have gone through. Really what it is that you have people on wait lists who are determined eligible for family care. They were given the choice to enroll in family care or other long-term care programs, but I just kept this simple to family care. Same thing is coming for a program called IRIS and PACE and Partnership, but I didn't want to complicate that. So let's say we had a person on our wait list eligible for services financially and functionally. They, through a certain period of time that we had to enroll people, convert people off the waiting list to family care, were given an opportunity. If they so chose an opportunity, then a member center, once they determined eligible, a member center plan was developed, as Tara said, around them, and they just were brought into the program and there as long as they maintain eligibility and chose to stay. So it just was a phase-in plan for us that we had, I think, over 18 months that we had to enroll everybody in La Crosse County that were on wait lists, plus then deal with people who were in the community that get to be eligible, or people that said, I don't want to be in a wait list. Why would I want to be in a list for 10 years? But as soon as the wait list ended or was nearing the end, just like it is in our partner counties, all of a sudden they come out what we call the woodwork effect, and all of a sudden the interests want to go on because there's hope for them again.
Maureen Friedland.
It sounds like you're saying that under this new system, some individuals will just not be able to get services because somebody else is getting services. And that we were finding a way, even with a wait list, for people to get services, although maybe not under the best system that we thought possible for them. And I just don't understand how some people who are eligible for services won't get them. How can you say that one person's worth, one person's needs are more important than another person's needs, that someone who qualifies for services can't get them because somebody else didn't get off and the attrition rate isn't high enough? I just don't get it. It seems like a equal opportunity violation or discrimination
do too. We don't get it either, and how that can work, especially when you've been at full entitlement, as we and four other counties have been for a decade already, that you can now all of a sudden try to put a wait list into effect only based upon attrition slots. We don't understand it, and so we'll have to redevelop some wait list rules based on some kind of prioritization, like risk assessment of that individual. If they have other choices for residential living situations or not. We have a lot of individuals who end up in our adult protective service system as a result of our risk, so we'll have to readdress that and try and make those determinations if this truly goes into effect. But you're right, it pits one person against another. You have the haves and the have-nots, as we call them.
Other questions? Tara Johnson?
Oh, just wanted to point out really quick, if we could, I wanted Lori Graff to speak to. There is an issue in terms of how the first issue we talked about as far as IM administration impacts family care. And Lori could explain that.
Yeah, I think it's just important to point out that economic support determines the eligibility for family care, and they were a big part in the success of the pilot of family care. And what we've seen since 2009, when the state decided to implement Badger Care Corps, which is medical assistance for those without children, is that they were not processed timely, the cases weren't, and we're very concerned about whether those applying for family care will also have delayed eligibility determinations, because none of this matters if the eligibility for financial isn't determined before all of this comes into play. The state came to us shortly after the Badger Care Corps started and asked counties for help because they could not process the applications. We worked for 6 months in 2009 to process the Badger Care Corps applications. And in fact, the counties that did that processed half of the applications that came into the state for Badger Care Corps, which is state responsibility, but counties actually ended up doing that. So when we talk about family care, I just think it's important to remember that if the applications aren't being processed for financial determinations, that the family care won't go through. So.
Tara.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So not typically being a conspiracy theorist myself, it does feel like there's the potential for it to be a self-fulfilling. If you aren't timely in the income eligibility process, then you have fewer people who are eligible to enter family care, and it appears as though nobody's being hurt by it.
And other Medicaid programs and food share.
Yeah. Question about the waiting list, whatever size they are, and I have the privilege of serving on the Western Wisconsin CARES Board, and I can just imagine what tomorrow's meeting is going to be like. But I think what La Crosse County Board Supervisors need to appreciate is that if Dean is right, in guessing that La Crosse County, through our four-county ADRC, will be able to maintain the preferred status that we have in terms of referrals into Western Wisconsin Cares. It will mean that folks who are eligible in the other seven counties aren't going to get in as fast. So while that may feel nice for us, and it may help us keep our waiting lists down, the impact will be on real people, as Maureen said, likely in other counties that we partner with through Western Wisconsin Cares. Question to Dean, I guess, is those waiting lists, I'm assuming, are going to become the responsibility of the family care districts, or will counties have liability or responsibility for services to folks who are eligible but are sitting on a waiting list for family care?
It's our understanding that the counties will be responsible because the MCO, Wisconsin Cares, has no responsibility to serve non-members.
And where does our source of funding come from for that, then?
We have none currently.
Oh. Jill?
I want to ask Lori, my concern is what I've heard about the state and their ability to enroll people in a timely manner and also in a cost-effective and well-functioning manner. How would you tell us a little bit about Badger Care Core when that program was started, when they kind of rolled that out? Right. What's your opinion about how that went?
Well, they fully admitted that they underestimated the number of applications they would receive. I mean, you could only apply online and through the phone, but we knew that wouldn't work. So Lindsay Swartz actually came and did sessions right here in the boardroom that were full of people that could not use the computer to the degree that they needed to apply. So that was the first barrier. The second one was that they just simply didn't have enough staff. I mean, they're hiring private staff who are not trained in income maintenance to take the information. And then they have a dozen or so state staff who have to certify them. And if I were a state staff and having to certify them and take on the liability for the benefits, I'm going to go through that case very, carefully. And so that slows down the process, and that's what happened. They got this huge backlog of applications, 80,000 applications. And so then they turned to the counties and paid us overtime to process those applications. I don't think that was very good cost savings for them. After that was done, what they did is say that for better customer service and so that counties would have the ability to serve their customers, they gave us security access so that we could go in and work on Badger Care Core cases if there were problems. No funding went along with that, but the security access did. So what's happened is that the community does not see all the problems with Badger Care Core because somebody applies for benefits and they get started on the application, maybe even get all the information into the system, and it sits. We have tons of examples of cases where people have waited 8 months where they've applied for Food Share or Badger Care Core, and the application is just sitting there. And so they finally come into the county after they've tried to get through on the phone and they can't reach anybody or the person that on the other end is not trained in income maintenance. So they come into us, and of course we have security to be able to help. So our staff have actually been the ones who have done a lot of the work on these cases and gotten them through. The public, doesn't know that because we're just doing our jobs. I mean, we're here to serve people in La Crosse County, and that's what we've been doing. That's not going to happen if there's no income maintenance. If we're gone, I don't know where the customers will go.
And I'd also like to just say something about staff. I've been sitting in on the meetings that we've had with the state and the surrounding counties about regionalizing the changes when people have to do changes in their applications. And I was so, so proud to be from La Crosse County when Jim Jones saw, and surrounding counties saw, how well we did that work. He was very impressed with the the accuracy with the speed that we were able to, that staff was able to do that work, with the quality of work they did, and to see how they worked with the surrounding counties, their expertise was just far and above what I saw. Mm-hmm. And I just think the way we were headed was smart. Mm-hmm. To go to regionalization. Mm-hmm. To have 72 counties do that made mm-hmm. no sense to me. But we were going in a logical, a practiced, planned out way down the line to regionalization, and I thought that made so much sense. And hopefully that can get through, that message can get through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, our change center was working really well, and like Jason said, all the other counties wanted to actually pay La Crosse County to continue providing services in their communities, but that puts all this to an end. But yeah, I mean, our phone calls in our change center, not over 90% of them are answered within 30 seconds. Even after the state took over Milwaukee, their wait times on the last report that I saw, because is about a half hour. 27 minutes is their average wait time for their call center in Milwaukee, that's state run. They have to provide monthly reports because they have a lawsuit, and so the defendants get the report every month from Milwaukee.
And I think we have to remember that this is the service you're providing, this is basic survival. This is basic survival.
Mm-hmm. Indiana did this a few years ago, and they're in the middle of a lawsuit because they got lawsuits from customers that weren't being served, some pretty serious medical conditions as a result of not getting services. And actually it's a countersuit between the state of Indiana versus the private agency that they hired to do the work, and then they ended the contract early. So there's a lawsuit between them trying to, I guess, shift the blame. But they've gone so far that actually when they did stop it and tried to make it, now they tried to reform it into a county-based system like what we have as much as they could without going back, because they had gone so far with privatization that they couldn't actually easily turn back. So they actually do have a county presence, and they're trying to run it like a county-run income maintenance like we have here, but there's still a lot of problems because it's hard to go back after you do all that.
Other questions? I want to do a quick follow-up with Dean. The people on the wait list that we're going to possibly end up with, are those going to come in, say, through court orders?
They could, under Chapter 51. And could come in to us and be ordered for us to serve them, as it did in the past. Again, that was part of the risk removal that we had with the full care, family care entitlement that came into being. So could happen, but probably take a while, but obviously the risk is to us again.
I remember those days when a guardian ad litem or a guardian would file the action in court, and the judges didn't care that we had no money. It was just do it.
Yep, I was in court a lot those days, yep.
I remember that. Other questions or comments? Thank you. Very interesting report. Appreciate all the work that you do.
If we can go back to the first slide, that's actually jumping ahead, sorry. All the way back to the start, there we go. Yeah, to the first one. I want to just do a little brief intro. If none of that moved you about any of the individual clients that we heard about in aging or income maintenance, I want to bring something back to, because whether you support the governor's actions and his administration, whether you don't, whether you're not sure until you hear more information, recognize that all of that's going to have serious implications for our entire revenue base within human services. It ends up losing federal revenue that pays for infrastructure. It also ends up losing the revenue that pays for mental health, family and children services throughout the rest of the system, as well as both nursing homes and family care. It ends up having ripple effects, which, by the way, just so everybody keeps your eye on the ball, none of that can be made up with 50% of WRS shifted to employees. None of that replaces anything that is supposedly the solution of the tools that we are supposed to be given in the budget repair bill. I just want everybody to keep an eye on the ball that one of the reasons our tax levy is as low as it is because we go out and work as a team to maximize non-local revenue sources to control property taxes. And it's not about Steve O'Malley or Jason Witt or Gary Engelson figuring that out. It's about the creativity and dedication of people that first meet client needs and secondly say, how can we make sure to maximize non-local revenue sources? None of that's addressed within the budget that we can see right now. That's how severe this is. The cuts that we've been able to identify that are direct, not the indirect ones that I just talked about, not the ones that we just highlighted, most cuts are, as I predicted, in calendar year 2012 that we've been able to identify, not the trickle-down that we're talking about. I believe, again, and I've said this publicly, the budget repair tools that are proposed are not tools. They are not needed. We've been doing a good job here. We don't have to eliminate collective bargaining to control budgets. But don't let anybody kid you. This continues the past practice of Democrat and Republican administrations of simply shifting costs to counties, ignoring inflation, ignoring demand. It avoids responsibility for state-imposed mandates. And it caps property taxes at 0%, which we've already done 2 years in a row. It's not a reform budget. It's primarily a political policy document. And even if you agree that that is the authority that the governor has and the legislature has, the fact is that none of these things are well thought out, even into a transition. Let's talk about income maintenance. If we had time to actually think through the transition without losing valuable employees and actually figure out how to make the transition from a public system to a privatized system, we could figure out to do it better than just a proposal that we hear about in today's budget, and we won't know till probably May or June if it's even adopted. How do you make a transition with very real people's lives, let alone the staff that are wondering, okay, where do I go? What am I going to do with this? And what happens to the clients that we end up serving? The only thing new I can see in here, other than major service and policy changes that are rushed with details poorly considered and complexity unwilling to be acknowledged, because you can't put this stuff in a bumper sticker. It's already longer than that television camera is going to be able to cover and explain to the public, or that some people even have patience to listen to during an evening. The only thing new in this budget is a shift of cost to employees and eliminating bargaining, but it's not going to make up for the cuts that I just talked about. It's about 1,300 pages. It's difficult to get all the details involved. Remember that most of what ends up happening is in the middle of our county budget. We're here in county 2011. Most of it will start to impact us in 2012 and 2013 of all these cuts that I'll end up talking about. Here's the cuts that we've been able to identify so far, made in calendar year 2012. None of these, with one exception, ends up impacting us in the calendar year that we're in. We estimate that the shared revenue loss will be 24%, or about $1 million. General transportation aids will be 10%, $160,000. Child support is a 50% cut in state funding that area. I'll explain the complexity that the state doesn't seem to understand, that ends up losing more federal revenue again than the $71,000. Youth aids is cut by about 10%. We believe about half of that will be in 2011, half of that will be in 2012 because of the overlapping biennium, but that's not clear yet. It may actually all impact us this year. We get a slight increase in formula and basic community allocation, but as Jason and his staff just described for us, that all gets end up taken away right away in this takeover. Income maintenance is about $1.4 million. Most of the complicated impacts are in human services and Medicaid, and many of the things are identified just as administrative rule changes and don't identify what the actual impact will be, so we can't even change budget based on it because they're changing so many things at once within human services. The best we can tell is that there's no cuts to nursing homes at this point. I'm not positive about that, but that's what both Pam and Pete have provided from their associations. No new cost to solid waste. There are many areas of the budget that aren't directly impacted, but there are major client impacts in 2011 that we just talked about. We're in a position that the low-income folks that aren't even accessing services right now that go to low-paying jobs in this community are not going to be access transit just to get there. That's not on our budget, but it is about people's ability to get to work. I've taken the position that the budget repair bill is not needed, and particularly not in 2011. The premise that we've been sold in the media is that shifting 50% of pension costs, limiting wages to CPI, and eliminating nearly all bargaining is necessary to match the cuts in local aids in the budget. And then we're going to have a 0% operating levy as the cap. We've already done that 2 years in a row. We didn't need the state to tell us how to do it. We've already done it 2 years in a row. We didn't have those tools. We worked with our employees. It was not easy coming to agreements on collective bargaining, but we continue to work with our employees and respect them. The state cuts are in 2012 and beyond, and some areas are not even directly affected. But you can't just take a shift of pension dollars over and replace Medicaid revenue or federal revenue. It's not about flexibility, but forcing lockstep solutions for all. We will meet or exceed all targets without the budget repair bill if we're given the choice. Counties asked for mandate relief. There is none that I can find in the budget. By contrast, and some of you know that I wasn't a big fan of Governor Doyle. Have I made that very clear to folks? I haven't been. I've complained about him from day one. He never understood the word counties. He talked about schools. And I've said that in this forum. I've said it in other forums. He cut us by $700,000 in human services aides, $120,000 in shared revenue, but he didn't have to eliminate collective bargaining to do that. Here's an example of, and I think this goes back through Democrats, Republicans, all the way back to 86. That bottom part of the area graph is actual state funding, not adjusted for inflation, not any other way, but community aids to counties for human services. The only way we've been able to control tax levy is by maximizing any other eligibility of revenue by clients. Over that period of time, look at the kind of growth that's gone on, shifting to counties. And this is more of the same. In-state shared revenue, according to our understanding of the formula, and it's written like a horoscope as to how the cut was going to be made other than 24%, it takes La Crosse County back to the 1992 level of shared revenue. And there are no services that we're no longer to provide. In fact, we're getting some back, as you just heard, of people on waiting lists. I believe there was some requirement that we're actually going to have to take on some of the certification of adult family homes and some other things that are no longer our responsibility, with no additional funding to pay for it, and by the way, no staff left to actually do that. Let me just, and I could spend a lot of time on this, but I'm going to touch on a couple of things of major service and policy changes that are rushed with details poorly considered. We heard in the governor's budget reform repair bill that we should shift pension costs and eliminate most collective bargaining. It was announced on February 11th, and it was supposed to start approximately 30 days later with payroll by April 8th. Counties all across the state can't make changes that quick, let alone the issues that actually impact people directly. You can't make those kinds of changes that fast. If the legislature and governor want to make changes, they can give us transition time, they can work with us. That's one of the reasons that I recommended the collective bargaining agreements, as well as we bargain those in good faith. We have some time to be able to make the change if that's what's imposed on us. One of the things that they didn't recognize that by eliminating all collective bargaining, all of a sudden we all need to reinstitute something old called the civil service system that even gives employees the right to have a fair hearing if they're disciplined, to actually have some kind of a process if you end up losing your job, or all the rest of the details that we assume in standard practice for the last 40 years of bargaining agreements that describe hours, sick leave, vacation, any of all the things that we've always assumed. They forgot that all that's eliminated by eliminating collective bargaining, and we have to recreate something called the civil service system. Wisconsin Counties Association has recommended that if this passes, and we're supposed to pull this together quickly, is a transition team on the local level, because we've got to figure out all the implications in payroll, finance, human resources. People have rights whether you have this or not with a civil service system. What is their property right to sick leave that they have in their current bank? What's the property right to a flex plan? What's their property? All these things, again, if the governor and legislature want to change this, they've got to think through the implications. You don't just change on basically a 30-day notice is what he had expected. If it was not gridlock in Madison. This would have been imposed in counties all across the state, some that are as large as us and could respond quickly, and counties that are very small that couldn't, that haven't even done the upgrades in the existing payroll system to comply with the 2% change in Social Security. I mean, there's that much difference all across the counties. You also read that they exclude protective service from the pension shift, even though our law enforcement staff came to our agreement and didn't choose to go to arbitration. They agreed with all bargaining units. They want to exclude from protective service the pension shift, even though they already received 20% on top of their wages. But for whatever reason, they didn't include the sheriff, chief deputy, captains, or sergeants. So that means that if you are a manager, if you are a supervisor, making the hard calls, making the supervisory calls, making all the decisions for how your staff needs to make their decisions on protecting our liability and maybe disciplining an employee if they need it, you don't get that same pension shift. In fact, you're going to take a cut in pay for being a manager. By the way, the chief deputy and captains don't receive overtime like the staff that they supervise. Of course, neither does the sheriff. So you're actually going to see a cut in pay. But then I just read Legislative Fiscal Bureau is saying that it's unclear whether or not you can cut elected officials on their pension, and that it will have to be determined by a court, because someone will have to either challenge it or just absorb the hit. And out of 72 sheriffs, I imagine someone's going to challenge whether or not that can be changed. Again, issues that are rushed with details poorly being considered. Child support cut loses federal revenue. I've got a slide to show you that. We just talked about IM clients and all of that with very little notice. And finally, the federal transit funding is put in jeopardy for both MTU and elderly. Here's just one example. And we could go item by item and do formulas and show you a number of these complex things. Okay, so it sounds real good at the state level. Let's cut in half in 2012 our federal support, our state support of child support revenue. It goes from $8.5 million to just about $4 million. $71,000 is the cut to child support. So we would cut $71,000 received from the state. It also ends up mirroring $137,000 of federal funding that we end up losing, because that would lower our overall spending in that area, which we're not allowed to do. That's a total cut of $209,000, or about 22% from a budget of $937,000. We're told that we're given the tools to make up these differences. A pension shift for those 13 employees would generate $27,000, that 50% shift to them. But also reduces federal revenue again by $18,000, so it gains us $9,000 by shifting those costs to those employees. Our choice is we either must come up with another way to fund $71,000, I don't know, I suppose from the other counties, county employees that are paying pensions share now, to add to the child support levy of $112,000, which is an increase of 63%. Did I mention to you that we're at 0% for the whole levy? I didn't want you to miss that. Because, or we have to cut staff in an office right now by 22%. Those 13 employees have among the highest caseloads in the state. They're consistently the top one or two in the state of handling caseloads. Now, does anybody think that non-custodial parents ought to be paying child support? That's why the system exists. Now, the hope is that the agency has been able to get the attention of the administration, and they may be able to correct that. But that's an example when you rush major decisions through, even if you agree with them, even if you think that's the right thing to do, you've got to think through implications, and I don't see a lot of evidence of that. One thing that I do appreciate that I wish one gentleman was here to be able to see is that the 0% property tax cap plus new construction is actually something I've never touted a great deal or relied on a lot. I said, we've got a responsibility to control property taxes. I just do the best job I can. I lead a team that tries to bring you good decisions. But within this, they talk about lowering that 3%. Remember, the levy limit right now is 3% plus new construction. Have you ever heard me talk about new construction much? Nope. I've talked about what our levy is. I've talked about what we need, what our choices are, and what we've tried to do. Well, in the governor's budget, he talks about 0% property tax cap plus new construction. This is a history of what that new construction would have generated over the last 10 years. The new tax base actually lowers, it's a recognition that new tax base lowers the impact on existing taxpayers. You've seen this slide before, where not adjusted for anything, not adjusted for inflation. This is over good times and more recent times, a history of our levy history. and I just matched those two together. In other words, there's a recognition in levy limits currently and under the governor's bill that new construction actually doesn't raise taxes on existing taxpayers. So if you can keep your taxes to that level, you're allowed to do that. This is historically what would have happened, so that levy history shows that new tax base supported almost half, 43% of every new dollar we asked of taxpayers over the last 10 years. Although I know that there have been some critics that have said that our taxes went up too much over that period of time. Here's exactly recognized in the existing levy as well as in the new authority how much new construction makes up of our tax increases over the last several years. So by taking that away, this is the effect on existing taxpayers of the last 10 years of this budget, not adjusted for inflation, only reduced by new construction, 29% over 10 years, or about 2.9% average. In fact, it gets better than that to show you how tight it is. 1.8% average over the last 6 years has been the effective rate. And if you're keeping score, consumer price index over that same period of time was 2.3%, because we don't have the number yet for 2011. That our last 6 years has actually been less than the rate of inflation. Again, that's not me, that's not the board, that's this entire team of employees that's doing this job to correct that and control that for existing taxpayers. My summary of the budget repair bill and its effect on counties, because it's uniquely intertwined with the budget, is that it eliminates collective bargaining except for protective services. It sets CPI at wages. When we've been able to negotiate with our employees when we have difficult times, Dane County, by the way, with collective bargaining, negotiated a 5% decrease. You don't need to eliminate bargaining to work with your employees. It's about respect. Health insurance premiums to 12.6%. That's only if we're in the state plan. We've done some additional analysis. Not only are we 8% lower on our health insurance than the state plan, we're 8% than the average of comparable counties on health insurance. Our employees are working with us to control health care costs. Again, the best estimate is 45% of the reduction would be levy savings, but then buried in the budget repair bill is significant authority just given to the DHS secretary to make programmatic changes in Medicaid. In addition to privatizing the eligibility determination for folks, they're going to change the standards. So if people are confused about where they go find anything and whether or not they qualify, one person, the secretary, is going to have authority to just change that. So let's talk again. It's not just about the effect of pension cuts, whether or not you believe county employees should pay more or not. We'll make the change when the law gets impacted, obviously. Most general fund departments would save 100% levy. Hillview and Solid Waste would save no levy. Lakeview saves little levy, but it may reduce other revenue from the other sources that we get reimbursed on. Human services will vary by program how much that pension shift will happen. Only 28% of their levy, or 28% of their budget is from levy. If you compare with other counties across the state, I dare say most would not say only 28% of their human services budget is required to be funded by levy. It's because of the work that our staff does. Highway actually produces revenue that pays for state work more than the in addition to the GTA cut. But here's where it gets really interesting, because this isn't a game of politics. This is impacting real people's lives in real services. And I want to show you the complexity of the domino effect that is being considered that ends up impacting. Two-thirds of all the position vacancies in the county right now per year are at Hillview and Lakeview. We're already barely competitive for nurses, for nursing assistants, for support workers, for cooks, the people that are actually serving old people on a 24/7 basis. We can't have a huge amount of turnover, and our employees are saying, do I stay here? What's going to happen to me long term? Right now, it's harder and harder to fill positions that are there. Nurses are asking, how long do I stay? They're one of the reasons they stay with lower wages is because of the pension. Generally, our nurses make less than the private sector, but they make better pensions, so they want to stay. We have that kind of domino effect, and if we can't keep positions filled, those services don't happen. This is not a game of politics. It's if we're going to make a transition, we need time to work. And by the way, the nurses aren't union. They're non-union. They're under meet and confer. So if the law passes, it will impact everybody. And I've got nurses wondering how long do they stay. We can't work those shifts with vacant staff. Grandma or your aunt can't wait until we fill that shift. Make positions harder to fill and employees more incentive to leave. Sorry. The next bullet point is that over 350 employees in the county system are at age 55 this year or beyond. And Ray, in case you're keeping track, that includes me, so don't get your hopes up. I'm not leaving yet. But most of us are eligible for some level of early retirement. Right now, people, if you've read anything at all or heard anything at all, ETF is on overload, people asking for what are their projections because they don't trust what the changes might be. Now, that may sound good to some people, saying, well, Steve, if you left and we hired a younger, more dynamic person to be county administrator, maybe we'd figure out something better. But I'm the least of it. Every single position here to lose the intellectual history, the history of the organization, and to make that transition quickly without time for planning and making those kinds of transitions is irresponsible without having some kind of transition built into that, and let alone the logistics of 350 people out of an employee base of 1,300 to put that much in uncertainty. Just the dynamics around, that's more people than we have transitioning, which is right around 200 people a year in our current system. Last but not least is that it ends up having differential treatment, which may reduce interest in career progression. If the only people impacted by the change in pension benefits are non-union supervisors and managers, and they retire, who of the rest of our staff wants to go and take that job, particularly in law enforcement? And oh, by the way, the governor says he's not going to raise taxes. The last bullet point is WRS has determined that all of this will be post-tax. Before I left Minnesota, I paid part of my pension. The county or city that I worked for paid part of the pension, and it was tax-free, just like deferred comp, just like a 457. They haven't thought through the details enough to even make sure that the law complies with this, that all of us that will end up paying this when the law changes, because it hasn't changed yet, will end up paying taxes on it. By the way, both federal and state, mostly federal. So this generates more money for the feds, not for the state. Observations on changes to collective bargaining. We had a responsibility to bring you the contracts that we'd been working on for 6 months. We must still bargain in good faith, and until the law has changed, that's going to be my position as your chief administrator. I'm going to continue to bargain in good faith. But I knew we couldn't commit beyond 1 year because of all the uncertainty. The state has to change the law before you can count on savings from pension shifts before any of these shifts actually happen. You can't start counting savings you don't have. And finally, without compromise and negotiation, the losing party in any kind of setting always has options, and that's why we have the current system in place. It came into being in the 1970s to stop from having strikes, labor slowdowns. We've gotten a great return as a public, and frankly, most of the time, well over half the time, when we go to arbitration, the employer ends up prevailing. It's not a bad process. Both parties have to be fair to each other. Both have to work together. But as Milwaukee County Executive, the governor has lost several, at the time, court decisions that cost the county hundreds of thousands. Just this week, did anybody read about building security? Let me explain to you what happened in building security. You privatized all of building security, fired the existing employees. They went to court. 27 people ended up getting back pay. 21 were in a position to want to come back. They still have the contract with the private firm because they still are obligated to fulfill that contract. They now have more staff, both private and public, doing it, and it's cost hundreds of thousands of dollars in back pay. There's also another one where he ended up trying to change everybody's hours unilaterally without county board approval down to 35 hours. That was overturned. So there was a bunch of back pay involved with that. That I don't know, but yes, I read that too.
No, I did.
Yeah. Yeah. And anyway, my point is that the governor and legislature have the right to change whatever they need to. You've got to figure out the transition. You've got to take time. I can have a personal and a professional opinion about it, but you don't do things overnight. You don't do things quickly. Right now we're in a position where it's unclear what any of this will do out of the budget repair bill as far as effective date. Remember, it was proposed February 11th. It was all supposed to happen within 30 days. The so-called savings that were going to be there are being stalled by a lack of quorum in the Senate. Assembly is challenging the vote. The unfair labor practice by Council 24 will potentially lock this up in court. Contract violation and infringement on home rule is being challenged by the City of Milwaukee City Attorney. Potential labor actions. The best estimate, and I frankly have a hard time handicapping this, but I believe with the majority of the legislature, with a Republican governor, that this will pass. So it's probably, it's been delayed by at least a month and may be delayed longer, but I believe most of what's been proposed, including what we've warned you about tonight, will end up passing. And we will just have to try to pick up the pieces. I provided this information before. I've actually got handouts, so you can get all of this information. But again, by delaying it just 1 month, our county budget for just bargaining units, I don't have all employees up there because you haven't dealt with any issues of non-union, including nurses, including other staff, that the voluntary unpaid time off for all bargaining units saves us more in our budget than imposing a CPI for the full year and taking away pension for that partial year. The longer it takes to actually put this into effect, the better off we are. And what's more important is we're still engaged with our employees. We're still trying to help figure out this transition because, yes, public employees have said that with respect for collective bargaining, they will adapt to the changes that have to happen with pension. We just need time to make that transition. So what we know so far about the state budget is most cuts that we've been able to identify are a bit more than Governor Doyle, but they're still manageable, and we can work with that. It still continues the longstanding practice in Wisconsin of shifting costs to counties and avoids any new responsibility for state-imposed mandates, with the exception of trying to take over income maintenance, which they don't have a great track record of taking over services. It impacts to clients and community will be significant very early on. It caps property taxes at zero plus new construction. We've already done that each of the last 2 years, and evidently we're going to need to do it for the next 2 years. As I've said, we didn't need to have the state tell us how, and if you want to look at in your budget summary, page 6 reminds everybody we weren't doing this and waiting for somebody to look just the last 2 years. We're $3 million under the levy limit that would have allowed us to go up, and we're $1 million under the rate limit. We've been trying to be responsible. Even though we've been coming up close to the rate limit, which only affects a few of us, we're still under that. I could have brought you a budget last year, but said that wasn't responsible in a down economy. We're going to do the best we can. And the only increase that we did the last 2 years was for debt service for the law enforcement center. Again, that's because of the team of people that we work together with. So there's some significant impacts here. We'll get through this just like we always have, but again, I thought it was more important to have the others start out with their presentation than mine.
Questions for Steve. Don Bina.
You gave a good resume about the budget. You didn't include in that anything that may or may not happen on the federal level, because there are going to be good changes point. There, like yep. medical assistance and MA. There's all kinds of things that nobody knows what's going to happen, because they aren't going to vote on that budget until June, July, or August or something. And so you need to take in consideration that these aren't the only cuts we're looking at. There may be more.
That won't be made up by pension shifts.
Vicki Burke.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to thank you again to the Human Services staff for being here this evening, and we certainly do respect what you do.
Maureen Friedland.
You've continually emphasized that La Crosse County has been efficient and we've found our own solutions and so forth. Now, through your associations with other counties and through the county's association and so forth, do you feel that other counties are also asking why these drastic changes have to be made so quickly, or are we ahead significantly, but perhaps other counties can use this remedial kind of looking over their shoulder? What do you think?
Counties don't speak with one voice by any means. You've got counties everywhere from saying this is exactly what they want, and they don't have as many clients to serve, and they want these changes and fully support the governor, to those who will probably speak as loudly as I am that this is too much, too fast, without thinking through all the implications. WCA's board of directors just this past week went on record not taking a position.
Other questions or comments? Ralph Geary.
Yeah, we know the state's $3.6 billion or whatever they're in debt, and they want to have a balanced budget. Are we having any departments work on areas, well, if we had to have cuts, we'd rather do this and this than this?
One of the first presentations when we got the budget repair bill, I identified a whole list of things. There was actually a handout. We've been preparing for these types of things. Remember, most of this is for the 2012 budget. We've already started to eliminate the management positions that we budgeted to eliminate this year. We continue to go through a systematic means of looking at management structure. We're already going through the things that we can. We will bring you choices for the 2012 budget.
I'm not talking about us. Are we sending the state any suggestions, or is other counties, your counterparts, are you getting together and say, well, maybe we could absorb a cut in this area or that area or something else?
We have lists of the WCA County's platform that identifies mandates. None of them were addressed in here. The way that the budget repair bill was rolled out was Thursday night before it became public. The governor asked to meet with two select people from counties, two select people from cities. A number of people rolled it out, said, I'm going to give you the tools because the cuts are going to be so severe, you're going to need to eliminate bargaining and pensions. And if you, you know, if you can support me, that's what I'm asking. If you don't, I just prefer your silence. They didn't ask for input on any of this. They still haven't asked for our input.
Tara Johnson.
But, Steve, is it fair to say, to Ralph's question, that the approach that counties, either collectively through WCA or through administrators group or whatever, the approach that we have taken is to ask for mandate relief? Instead of saying, don't cut us in youth aids, instead cut us over here, the approach has been relieve mandates so that our costs can go down and we can manage that process county by county. Is that fair to say that mandate relief
exactly.
is really the
exactly.
the message?
And we've been trying to lead by example. The regionalization is a perfect example that is more cost-effective, saves the state and counties money. We're pilots for that. We've done it time after time. We said that operating a county nursing home just on one county's back doesn't make sense. We created a regional model that shares costs. These are complex issues. It's not just, as you said, don't cut me in youth aids, cut me in shared revenue. It's doing things more efficiently and effectively, and that doesn't happen overnight. Any one of these ideas could, if the governor wanted to do these and do them cost effectively, would ask us to lead a regionalization effort and show dollars, actually be a part of the transition, than to wait for the next 3-4 months on pins and needles, wondering what the impact is going to be, and then try to figure out how to implement.
And then, if I can, also to Supervisor Friedland's question about, you know, have counties spoken with one voice? I don't know if it was last week or the week before, there were close to 500 elected officials, not just counties, but municipal elected officials, school board folks, who jointly signed a letter that I think initiated in Eau Claire with their county board or their city council opposing the budget repair bill. And I don't know if there was a similar approach taken for elected officials across the state that supported the budget repair bill. I would have asked Mr. Feehan if he was here, but maybe there were signatories to a letter like that that I didn't hear about. But I know that there were, like I said, close to 500 statewide who signed a letter, you know, taking that official stance in opposition to the budget repair bill, maybe a week or 10 days ago.
Other discussions, questions, comments? Seeing none, anything further, Steve? That gets us to cards and correspondence, which is on the board over there. Committee meetings during recess, none of those. And suggestions for future agenda topics. Anybody have any? Don Bina.
I don't have any suggestions. I just was wondering. They rescheduled the legislative hearings by WCA. And evidently, they have the hearing from 3 until 6 o'clock the night we have our county board meeting. And I was wondering if we couldn't have them change that for some how or other, because you're not going to go to Toma to the legislative meeting at 3 o'clock, get done at 6, and be here at 6. It can't happen.
Yeah, I'm not sure who to talk to in that respect, but WCA? Okay. Okay. Any other future agenda topics or announcements? Seeing none, is there a motion to adjourn by Jerry Sobranek, second by Bill Brockmiller? All in favor say aye. Opposed, no. Carried unanimously. Vicki, did you have something? I didn't see your hand.